Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. One of the great stories in North Carolina is the story of two immigrants who came during the 19th century and may be the most famous North Carolinians of all time. And of course, that we're talking about Chang and Ing, the Siamese twins who lived in North Carolina longer than they lived any other place. Like many other North Carolinians, I've always been fascinated with these twins. Therefore, I was excited when I saw that there is a book that UNC Press has published recently called The Lives of Chang and Ing, Siamese Twins in the 19th Century America. And we're fortunate to have with us by telephone the author, Joseph Andrew Orser. And Dr. Orser said I could call him Joe. So, Joe, welcome back to Chapel Hill.
Thank you very much for having me.
You did a little bit of your research for this book in Chapel Hill, didn't you?
I did a good deal. The Bunkers, Chang and Ing, the Bunker family have a collection at the UNC Library, the special collections there. So I've visited there a few times. And there's also, of course, the exhibit at the library as well. There's a museum exhibit on the twins and their lives.
Tell us a little bit the basic story of the Siamese twins. What is it about them?
The basic story first. They were born in Siam, which today we know as Thailand, in Southeast Asia. And they were born as conjoined twins, as we call it today, although for the longest time, you know, the term used to refer to conjoined twins was Siamese twins, and some still use that today. They were born conjoined in a small village near Bangkok, Thailand, Siam, in 1811. And while they were in Siam, they were, I'm using quotes here, discovered by a British merchant who kind of saw them and said, thought to himself, you know what, I think we can make a fortune. And so he, an American sea captain named Abel Coffin, signed them to a contract and then brought them over to the United States. And they toured in the United States, and they toured in Europe as well. They brought them over to the United States in 1829.
What do you mean when they toured? What did they? What could they do other than just be there?
Sure. So the type of exhibit kind of evolves over their careers. They would ultimately end up touring or exhibiting themselves for many decades. When they first arrived, they were essentially kind of placed on stage, advertised as these freaks of nature because of their conjoined bodies and also because of their Asian origins, their Oriental origins. There were a number, people would come just to gawk at them. Today we might call it a freak show. That wasn't what it was called then. They were called exhibits or levees. And people would come look at them. Their manager would say a few words about them. They would take questions from the crowd. When they were younger and more physically agile, they would sometimes do physical feats like tumbling. Uh-huh. They would play badminton with each other or play chess on stage. Ultimately, as they kind of grew older and more mature, it became more of a parlor setting where they would mingle and talk with people. And as I say, they did this. They came to the United States in 1829. They retired briefly in the 1840s, but by the 1850s, they were back on the road, and they would be doing this until 1870, 71.
That's a long time.
And, yeah.
And did that when they first came there? I don't know how to say this, but did they were young people. Did they go did they come to the United States voluntarily? Were they paid to do this, or who authorized these Western promoters to put them on display?
The promoters. Again, one British, one American. They approached. They had to kind of go through two kind of avenues. They approached the family, the mother especially. They also had to get permission from the King of Siam in order for the twins to leave the country. they signed a contract stipulating that the Twins would be, you know, going and performing, and they would be paid as a result of this. They also paid up front. They paid the mother. I call it a signing bonus. But they paid the mother some money up front as well.
So were they old enough to? They were not old enough at that point. They were kids at that point, not old enough to make their own.
They were 18. They were 18. And technically, they had to be. You reach your age of majority when you were 21. But they were presented as children when they came to the United States. They were presented as young children for a number of reasons. And so there was this idea that these are young boys. But in fact, they were 18, 19, 20, their first few years in the United States on exhibit. And then, you know, in 1832, when they did turn 21, they kind of, by that point, they had become sophisticated enough to understand the contract, understand their situation, their relationship with Abel Kaufman, and they successfully were able to negotiate or establish what they called their freedom. They came to realize that many Americans saw them as bonded labor or even as slaves because their mother had been paid some money up front for them. And this offended them both as individuals, but also because the idea that their mother sold them, it kind of wounded them. And they fought vigorously for their independence, for their freedom from Abel Kaufman successfully. And then so from 1832 on, when they were on tour, when they exhibited their bodies, they were kind of doing so as free agents. They were in charge of their shows.
So it was like
they profited from it.
Like all of this stuff with the professional basketball, when they became of age, they became free agents and they could contract with whomever they wanted to. They could get more money. And did they get more money? Did they get rich or did they just?
Based on the standards of the time, they did. They were rich. I think never as rich as people thought they were. But they were comfortable enough to ultimately, you know, let's see, in 1839, they decided to retire. They had been traveling, as I say, up and down the eastern seaboard. They had gone to Cuba. They had gone to Canada. They had gone to Europe. But by 1839, they retired. They had enough money, they thought, to kind of create a life for themselves. So they settle in Wilkes County, North Carolina. Buy an estate. They build a fancy house for themselves. They marry two white sisters. And ultimately, they're going to move to Mount Airy in Surrey County, and they're going to have a big plantation with dozens of slaves. They do become slave owners. And so they do accumulate a great deal of wealth. But they also end up having really big families. So together, they had 21 children between the two of them, and the cost of raising children, of educating them, of sustaining their farms, ultimately necessitated them going back on a tour by 1848-1849.
So how old would they have been when they first retired?
How old would they have been?
Right. Born in 1820 or so?
They were born in 1811, so they would have been 28 when they first retired.
So they went all over the Atlantic world, at least, America and parts of Europe, as relatively young people and made enough money so that they could at least contemplate giving up, retiring as performers in any event.
Exactly, retiring as performers. And when they did retire first in Wilkes County, they kind of experimented. They tried to open a store. It wasn't as successful as they would like. They were pretty successful farmers. But ultimately, they did have to return to show business in order to support their families.
Well, I'm visiting with Joe Osler, who is the author of The Lives of Chang and Ng, and of course we're talking about the Siamese twins, and after this short break, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Joe Orser, who is the author of a book about the Siamese twins who lived in North Carolina, the famous Chang and Ing. And Joe, you were, except for the fact that I was interrupting you, you would have gotten us all the way through the lives of the Siamese twins. But I was mostly interested in their time and why they came to North Carolina. And you had mentioned that they did settle in North Carolina after a long career and profitable career of displaying themselves across the country. These are two twins who are joined together and can't break apart, but they settled in North Carolina. Now, why in the world would somebody who's traveled all some people who've traveled all over the world choose to live in North Carolina? What did you find out why?
Well, there's no definitive answer. I mean, I do have some theories as to why. They themselves, over the course of their lives, there are these short biographies that are printed about them. And one of the biographies addressed this question, and it said that they were attracted to the mountains, to the open land, to the opportunity, to the clean air, to the opportunity to hunt and fish and kind of live as free individuals. And I'm sure that there was a part of that because everything suggests that they did enjoy living far from the hustle and bustle of urban life. They did enjoy hunting and other such kind of sport. But there are also, reasons in terms of what was happening in the United States that kind of, I think, pushed them in the direction of where they end up, North Carolina. It would have made sense in some ways that when we think about it, the South was a slave society. The North was an urban, more kind of urban society. And it makes sense that, these two world travelers would, have preferred to be in a more cosmopolitan setting, such as the North. But a couple of things are happening in the North. Late 1830s, early 1840s, when they do settle in North Carolina. One is there's a rise in immigration. And so there is a kind of a reaction against immigration in the North. And that certainly had an effect on the twins and how people kind of received the twins.
So there was less, you're suggesting that there was less racial prejudice against the Siamese twins in the South than there would be in the North, although clearly the South was, the slave society was racist to the core.
Yeah, well, yes. Yeah, so to get straight to the point, I think that's right, what you just said, that that there is less, as two Asian men in the South, there is black and white in the South. And so the fact that these are two people who kind of do fall, who are different, there is, and clearly they're men of means, they're world famous. They're not slaves, clearly, by the time that they arrive settle in North Carolina. And so they are received with open arms in Wilkes County. And then the fact of slavery allows them to become masters, literally. They buy black men and women, boys and girls, and that fact allows them to kind of rub shoulders with slaveholding elite in northwestern North Carolina, and this is something that they kind of through the years on tour, they become very savvy businessmen, savvy kind of readers of social dynamics, and they once they settle in North Carolina, one of the first things they do is they identify who are the community leaders, and they look for ways to ally themselves with those leaders to kind of create some sort of bond and get in their good graces so that they have both the social connections, they have the kind of symbolic position of being slaveholders. They do have money, and so they're able to kind of establish themselves in both Wilkes County and then in Surry County in Mount Airy.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned that they did is that in addition to buying farmland and establishing farms, that they each got married. And I think every time you mention the marriage of the twins, the question arises, well, and it was sort of like a how did they do it question. And so you did a lot of research, not so much on the mechanics of this, but in terms of the social aspects of how they worked it out to court and start families with two sisters. Can you tell that story for us?
Well, yes. I can't tell it as in as much detail and with as much authority as I wanted to. That was actually one of the first questions that I asked in my research. And in fact, I also did research in Raleigh in the state archives, and I went through all sorts of county records in an attempt to kind of decipher, you know, was there anything in the written record at all? You know, how and why did these four people end up, these two couples end up marrying? And I was able to find some interesting stuff, but I was never able to, you know, definitively answer, you know, this is why Chang and Ang married, Chang and Ang Bunker married Adelaide and Sally Yates, the two sisters that they married. But in part, the answer kind of goes back to those connections that I'm talking about. Some of their connections that they made were in-laws or related in one way or another to the Yates family. Again, their wives came from the family of David and Nancy Yates. And so when they were in the area that they settled in Wilkes County, the people that they came to know kind of put them in the same social circle. In fact, their close friend and manager, a man named Charles Harris, married a woman who was related to the Yates family as well. So there are kind of social connections going on. One of the great, I'm going to use the word myth, of their courtship and of their marriage is that the society around them strongly objected, that stones were thrown, the Yates family house was attacked by an angry mob and that sort of thing. One of the things that I was doing was trying to either prove or disprove that story. It emerges out of nowhere in the 1960s. And I was unable to find any evidence whatsoever in a highly litigious society. If you go through the criminal and court records of Wilkes County at that time, there were suits and battery and assault charges about all sorts of things, but there's nothing that's completely silent with respect to Chang and Ang and the Yates, Yates family. And so I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory that there were mobs as a result of this wedding. At the same time, you know, it clearly must have been a topic of gossip and whispering campaigns and that sort of thing.
Well, that's interesting. Did they have happy marriages?
I think that they had very, happy marriages mean something different today than it did then.
Uh-huh,
And so, you know, today when we think of a happy marriage, we think of a wife and a husband who are best friends or very close friends and they're buddies with, well, I don't know, you know, there's a question about whether we should be friends with our children or not, but, you know, who have a warm relationship with their children. And romance between married couples didn't work the same back in the mid-19th century, especially in the 19th century South. And so they had very fulfilled marriages. The the couples stayed together from 1843 until when they got married, until the twins' death in 1874. They were having children, both couples were having children into the 1860s. Both wives appear to have played active roles in looking after the household, especially when the twins would go on tour and take some children on tour. And so in every respect, they seem to have had a normal marriage in a lot of ways. You know, one of the things that a lot of critics then and today sometimes point at is that the two families didn't necessarily get along. By the late 1840s, the two families, Chang and Adelaide and Ang and Sally, had created separate households. In the early 1850s, legally, there would be the twins would divide their estates. And people point to this and say, see, they weren't happy family. But, you know, these are two growing families. And, you know, under what circumstances would two brothers who are married to two sisters want to raise their families under a single roof? You don't see that ever. And so that's just not a valid line of attack, I don't think, with respect to whether they were happily married. I think that their marriages were fulfilling. And I think that, you know, as husband and wife, that the two couples got along just fine and had, you know, large and for the most part, successful families.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Joe Orser, who is the author of The Lives of Chang and Ing. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, we're talking about the North Carolina twins. Oh, I should call them the Siamese twins because that's what everybody else called them. And Chang and Ing were maybe over time, the most famous North Carolinians ever. And Joe, sir, you've been good enough to talk about the twins. I wonder if you'd talk to us a little bit about whether or not we think of them as the Siamese twins as sort of one unit, but were they actually have different individual characteristics, or were they just alike?
Oh, they absolutely had different individual characteristics. Part of this you get through descriptions of their family, from their children, and that sort of thing. Part of this, and this is where it gets tricky, part of this is you get very contrasting descriptions of the pair from newspapers of the day. They would paint one brother as a teetotaler, the other as a drunk. They would paint one as a Catholic, one as a Protestant, and a lot of times these newspapers are using the twins as kind of mirrors on American society as a way to kind of illustrate the divisions in society and the ways in which in this United States you still have these kind of opposite strands of thought and of action going on. And so sometimes it gets kind of difficult to get at, you know, who, you know, what in fact were the individual characteristics of the two brothers. But one, Chang is, and if Chang and Ang, if you were looking at them, Chang would be the brother on your right. Chang is often kind of portrayed as the more volatile, the more vocal. When people do talk about alcohol consumption, they often say that Chang consumed more heavily. But also, a lot of times, he's portrayed as more shrewd and calculating in a positive way. That he's kind of the brain. Ang is portrayed as more quiet, kind of more because of the way that the two brothers stood. Ang could stand up straight, relatively speaking, whereas Chang was kind of bent over a little bit more. And so, Ang is portrayed as stronger. And so you do have certain characteristics that come out. Interestingly, now let me add this one last thing before I let you, before I let this line go. Interestingly, when they write letters, they're writing. They do write in a single voice almost always, and they sign it Chang'ang. And so you cannot go to the letters that they write or that they have that they dictate. Sometimes they write themselves, sometimes they dictate. You can't go to those and really get the individual characteristics of the twins because they kind of write as a joint body in those instances.
Well, no, I hadn't even thought about that or even how they would write with the area where they come together, sort of, the would be very difficult to write. So it was one left-handed and one right-handed in terms of writing. I never worried about that very much. But it leads me to ask another question that haunts me, and that is I have so much trouble learning a different language. It's really gotten tough now as an older person, but even when I was young, picking up and speaking a foreign language is a matter of great difficulty. And here are these two country boys from Siam with no special talents or education come as 18-year-olds into the United States and then to Western Europe, and they're able to pick up and speak the language? Were they have a good working knowledge of English, both written and spoken? Or did they?
Certainly.
Was it gibberish that they spoke?
No, it was not gibberish at all. They had a very good working knowledge of English. Ultimately, their first 2 or 3 years, I think they kind of engaged in intense, if informal, language study, both with their managers, and then they would practice with the at the shows with the people that came to talk to them and that sort of thing. And if you read the newspaper accounts and if you read the biographies, you see that there is a both of those document a progression in their language skills. Initially, when they come, everything's through a translator. And then a year after they arrive, they're starting to pick up some language and can speak a couple of words. And then, 2 or 3 years later, people say they speak English fluently, which is an exaggeration. But it does suggest that, the level of English aptitude that they ultimately are able to have. And they're able, they live in a world where no one speaks either Siamese, the Thai language, or Chinese, and so they live in a world where they have to know how to speak English and understand English, both and speaking and writing, in order to survive. And they do. They pick it up.
Well, did they speak in their native language to each other all the time, or did they ultimately come like some married immigrants to be able to speak in English to each other, even though their native language is something different? How did that work?
Well, you know what? There is absolutely no evidence to suggest that they did speak to each other. Ultimately, in fact, a lot of newspapers would say that they seem very silent with one another. They don't necessarily communicate much. They must have, you would assume that they must have, said, all right, let's go this place, let's go that place. But there's no evidence that says, either what they said or what language they said. I would guess it would probably be ultimately more English than Siamese. Late in their lives, someone who had been to Siam and came back and encountered them at a fair and asked them, do you ever plan to go back to Siam? And they said, no, America is our home. We're Americans now. And I think that kind of that's accurate. That actually represents both in the way that they lived, the way that they thought, the way that they talked. And let me add one other thing with respect to how well they spoke English. Some newspapers said they spoke it perfectly. Others would make fun of their accents, their syntax, and that sort of thing. And oftentimes, those descriptions kind of go, fall back to what is the newspaper's agenda. because some newspapers, for whatever reason, wanted to print a very positive representation of them, and others wanted to attack them as immigrants, as men who Asian men who had married white women, and this and that and the other. And so, the only way that we know for sure what their English might have sounded like is a couple of letters that they wrote in the 1850s to their wives. And that does suggest, and this is written English, and, you know, today, even today, people who speak fluently don't necessarily write perfectly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But in their written English, in those letters, the English is definitely doesn't adhere to the proper grammar that we at least subscribe to today. So it does suggest some level of foreignness to the language, or at least not a mastery of grammatical rules, which doesn't, again, this is writing, it doesn't suggest anything about their spoken ability or their intellectual ability.
Wow. Well, if you joined us late, we're visiting with Joe Osser, who's the author of The Lives of Chang and Ing, Siamese Twins in 19th Century America. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Joe Osser, who is the author of a book published by UNC Press called The Lives of Chang and Ing, Siamese Twins in the 19th Century America. Got so much more to talk about. Before we get started, we're calling the Siamese twins. Were they Siamese? Were they Siamese or Thai? What were they?
Well, they were born in Siam. Their father was a migrant from China, and no one's entirely sure about their mother's kind of ethnic origins. But I kind of based on the evidence that I read, I think that she was part Chinese, part Siamese. In terms of, so, you know, and if you're counting, that means that technically, I guess, they're more Chinese than Siamese. But they were born in Siam, they were raised in Siam. They had more Siamese kind of they cultural attributes than Chinese. In terms of the language that they spoke, the evidence that I have seen suggests speaking was Siamese or Thai, but the contract that I mentioned earlier, that was in Chinese, actually, and so...
is the contract with their mother or with them to...
Yes, the contract, I'm sorry, exactly, mm-hmm. The contract with Abel Coffin that allowed them to leave Siam and come to the West was actually written in Chinese, which suggests that at least at some point they had some Chinese literacy when it came to, comes to reading. And their signatures are in Chinese as well.
Well, one of the fascinating things about your book about the twins was the impact of the Civil War or their adoption of the Southern way of life as impacted by the Civil War. Well, just first of all, when the Civil War came, were they pro-Union or pro-Confederacy? After all, they had spent much of their lives on tour in the metropolitan areas of the North, and so probably had lots of friends and connections up there.
Yeah. And, you know, earlier I had mentioned that newspapers tended to portray them as opposites. So a lot of newspapers portrayed one brother as pro-Union, the other as pro-Confederacy. In fact, one newspaper kind of portrayed the two getting into a violent fight over it. And in fact, what that's doing, that didn't happen. What that's doing is that kind of, they're using the twins as a metaphor for the country, for the nation. They were Southern through and through. They were Confederate through and through. In fact, later, after the war, they went on tour in England, and one of the reporters there asked them, so, you know, the American papers say that, you know, one of you was for the North, one of you was for the South, and one of the brothers replies, no, that's just the papers having fun with us. We were Confederates.
Well, they both families provided a soldier for the South, I guess. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes, both Chang's family and Ang's family each had one son that fought for the South.
Well, in the aftermath of the war, did the were they received well in the North when they would go back on tour after the Civil War was over?
No, actually, not at all. And part of that has to do with resentment of the South. Some Northerners kind of wrote about the twins, the kind of with a distaste in their kind of language about the twins impoverished by the war and now coming to the North for a handout. These former Confederates, and this was part of a language of in the immediate aftermath of the war of resentment against the South and the need to reconstruct the South and that sort of thing. At the post-war period, which is the late 60s, early 70s, which is the last decade of their lives, is also colored by an anti-Chinese movement. And the twins' representations, the way that the Northern public talks about the twins is highly wrapped up with the anti-Chinese movement as well. So I think there's both of those kind of bullets that are aimed at them. One is their former Confederates, and the other is that they are Asian. And so their last decade alive, the decade after the war, they do try to go on tour again after the war to get money to because their estates are wiped out. They lose most of their estates are wrapped up in slaves. And so they lose a lot of their property. And so they have to go and try to find more money, earn more money. And those tours in those last 10 years were not greeted favorably by.
So there was a racism. This is interesting, I guess. In the North, there was racial feeling, anti-racial feelings against the Southern Chinese slaveholders.
And I think that's just that, Southern Chinese slaveholders. That kind in that phrase right there, it kind of shows just the level of complexity, I guess, that the twins represented, because they were so many different things. And at that particular moment, the late 60s and early 70s, none of those things were seen favorably in the North, at least.
Well, you mentioned, you talk a lot about the children of the Bunker twins, the Siamese twins, and in North Carolina. We're interested in the fact that there are lots of Bunkers in North Carolina. In fact, I got a call just the other day from a really nice guy, Henry Bunker, who said, "Why don't you come to the Bunker reunion this year? The ambassador from Thailand is coming to join us for our picnic." And he said, "We'll have hundreds of people there."
You should go. I went last year. I've been one or two times before. It's a wonderful affair. It's in Mount Airy. You can learn so much, talking with the descendants of Chang and Eng. As you mentioned, there are just, I think there are thousands of them at this point. Each brother, together the brothers had 21 children, and not all of those children went on to have their own family or even survived into adulthood. But enough of them did that a genealogy is hundreds and hundreds of pages, very thick book.
We just got a minute more, and I'm always interested. Now, you work, a large part of your life on this book, The Siamese Twins. And what have you learned since the book was published that you wish you'd known so you could have put it in the book that you can share with us? Is there anything new that you learned?
Since I published the book?
Yeah, since you published the book. It's okay to say not really. Got it all.
the things that I've learned in the meantime have more kind of amplify what I already said.
Uh-huh.
And so I continue to find references among people to the twins, seeing the twins on tour or not seeing the twins on tour, but still knowing about them and using the twins to imagine what Siam must have been like and that sort of thing. And those are things that I write about. But this, the evidence that I keep on finding suggests that there would have been, I could have done more with that. One thing that I am kind of looking at and I wish I had been able to do more of would have been to focus on the enslaved African American men and women and boys and girls that they had. I talk about that in the book, but not nearly as much as I would have liked. And I wish that I did have more evidence to kind of explore that dimension.
Well, you have so many wonderful facts that you've shared with us today and in your book, The Lives of Chang and Eng. Thanks to you, Dr. Joseph Osser, for sharing it with us.
And thank you so much for having me, DJ.
Thanks to all of you for listening. This is DG Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.